Democratic lockout. That's the concern the party faces in several California districts that it might otherwise flip from Republicans, including one seat currently held by the man known as Putin's favorite congressman. This is Keys to the House, the podcast from Capital Public Radio about the battleground congressional races and the themes that could determine the election. I'm your host, Ben Bradford. California has unusual primary rules, where the two candidates who get the most votes, regardless of party, advance to the November general election. That could work against Democrats in otherwise winnable races, locking them out of seats needed to win control of the House. And there's no better example of this than in the race for Congressman Dana Rohrabacher's seat in Orange County. We're joined today by Jack Pitney, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
And the guy tracking California's ballots as they're coming in, Paul Mitchell of Political Data Incorporated. Hey, Paul.
How you doing?
Doing well. So let's start with Rohrabacher and who he is, because he's kind of an eccentric and unusual, although conservative, Republican. Jack, what can you tell us about him?
Well, he's a local product out of Orange County. Worked in the Reagan White House as a speechwriter in 1988 when Dan Lundgren left his then congressional seat. Rohrabacher ran for it and was elected. He's served ever since. He has not developed a reputation as one of the leading intellectual lights of Congress, but I think the word eccentric is very appropriate. He's known for his longtime advocacy of reducing restrictions on marijuana. He's described himself frequently as a surfer dude.
Is he backbencher? Is the right word to call him a backbencher?
Yeah, and that's notable in that he has served in Congress for 30 years. He's not a committee chair. And to put it bluntly, he is not necessarily held in the highest esteem by his Republican colleagues. If he were, he might have advanced to a much greater position of responsibility within the House of Representatives. And his current activity with regard to Russia is a cause for some worry among his colleagues. He's become known as Vladimir Putin's favorite congressman.
Like, this is literally his nickname, right?
Yeah. The joke on Capitol Hill is that he is, Dana Rohrabacher or Moscow.
Yeah. And, as a matter of fact, this has come up on late night talk shows. Seth Meyers spent 7 minutes on The Late Show pretty recently talking about Rohrabacher.
He's been in Congress since the late 1980s and has developed a reputation for being the most Russia-friendly lawmaker, earning him the nickname Putin's favorite congressman. Although I can't think of anything more haunting than Vladimir Putin saying, "You are my favorite."
That's led to a lot of national attention to him, and one of the reasons why Democrats are targeting him, other than that his seat is potentially winnable for the party.
And this is a seat that Hillary Clinton won in, if you look at the district, the vote there, Hillary Clinton won this, even though Rohrabacher held on to win. This is one of the seven seats that Democrats are really targeting this election. And you would think that with, President Trump's unpopularity, with these sort of Russia allegations, this kind of unusual position, that this guy might be especially embattled. But you've had nine Democrats enter the race to unseat Rohrabacher. And Paul Mitchell, just set up for us what happens next.
Well, we are in an open primary in California. And essentially, the top two vote getters are the ones that will go on to the general election. And most people in California think the general election is a Democrat versus a Republican. That's what we're used to. But it's possible that all these Democrats start splitting up the vote and the top two vote getters are Republicans.
I mean, how possible is that?
It's unlikely.
Oh, you think it's unlikely that that's going to happen?
Well, I do think it's unlikely. I think that it's an unlikely event that's being talked about in about five districts. So when you take an unlikely event and multiply it and play it out five times, chances are it could happen somewhere. It might happen somewhere. This is an interesting one of the set of seats where Democrats are afraid that two Republicans will make the runoff because there's so many Democrats running. This is the one that has two of the most establishment Republican candidates running. You have the 30-year long-term congressman, and then you also have Scott Baugh, who's a former Orange County Party chair, former legislator, and a real name down in Orange County.
Right. So, I mean, the math here is basically you've got these two prominent Republicans, and then you have a lot of unknown or relatively unknown Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea being that let's say that Democrats get 60% of the vote and Republicans get 40%, but Republicans are splitting that 40% between two people and Democrats are splitting it between nine people or four people who are fundraising or whatever, then that would lead to the two Republicans getting the most votes.
Yeah, and that's exactly the scenario that Democrats are afraid of. And the term you use is important because you're saying if Republicans split the vote. So what has to happen here is that effectively the Republicans have to kind of tie. If it's here or in one of the other races around Orange County or even in the Central Valley, Democrats are clinging to these seats as, you know, kind of necessary set pieces in the overall take back of Congress.
Yeah, I think that's very important because Democrats, if they do take control of the House, it's probably going to be by a very small margin, which means that losing one, two, or three otherwise winnable seats could be crucial. And that's why a lot of money is coming into California and will continue to come into California through November.
Well, and the money, I mean, is so interesting because this is not an unknown problem for Democrats. As a matter of fact, you've got these several major, both national and statewide Democratic Party groups, most notably probably the DCCC, which is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which is about as boring a name as possible for the big money spender for the Democratic Party in congressional elections. And they have poured, I think it's $2 million now or almost $2 million to attack Scott Baugh, looking at him as kind of the weak link one. Maybe they can hurt his votes. And I don't think that they're trying to convince Republicans to then vote for one of the Democratic candidates. They're just trying to get Republicans not to vote for Baugh.
Absolutely. And that's and creating that separation between Rohrabacher and Baugh is what allows the Democrat, whoever is the top vote getting Democrat, to make it into the runoff. And the DCCC, albeit a boring name and most people don't even know what the DCCC is, they actually can be a lightning rod for controversy. And in fact, in Texas, they became a lightning rod where they dove into one of these congressional races, wanted to make sure they could win it in the general, and ended up dumping a bunch of opposition research on one Democrat, became the subject of the campaign, essentially.
The campaign arm for House Democrats did something unique. They're aggressively attacking a candidate in Texas. Now, what's surprising about that? Well, the candidate the Democrats are slamming is a Democrat.
What's really interesting is that in California, this fear of the top two and Democrats making the runoff in these congressional races that are competitive has actually given the DCCC the cover to come in and aggressively work to try to narrow the fields and try to influence the races in a way that in other states became anathema.
Although it's not like this is without tension. Hey, Jack, you want to cover the this little dispute between the California Democratic Party and the DCCC?
Well, they're supporting different candidates. The California Democrats are supporting Hans Kierstead, who's a scientist. Harley Ruda, who has the support of the DTRIP, is a business person. That makes it more likely that they're going to have this kind of a split. Both of them have fairly substantial funding, and that's a situation that keeps the Democrats up at night.
Yeah, and you know, as a matter of fact, there's a pretty harshly worded statement from California Democratic Party Chair Eric Bauman, who we talked to in our first episode, after the DCCC came in for another candidate, a different one than the state party endorsed. And Bauman said, when CDP, the state party, endorses a candidate, that candidate is the official candidate of the party, and the DCCC should tread carefully and openly supporting a different candidate. So you've seen this kind of tension. And I actually asked the DCCC's regional spokesman, Andrew Godinich, you know, what was going on there? Why go for Rauta? And here's what he said.
Both the California Democratic Party and the DCCC believe that we need to win elections and that we need to have a Democrat on the ballot in the general election in November. We have our own set of metrics separate from the California Democratic Party. We believe that Harley Ruda is the strongest candidate to advance to the general election.
So basically what happened is the California Democratic Party endorsed Kierstead, who is this stem cell researcher who's like really well-renowned. He's like sold some biotech businesses for reportedly $100 million. But he has some controversy, too. And I just think that's so interesting in these races. There's been an opposition research dump that turned up these allegations against Kierstead of running this really kind of loosey-goosey lab. And it turns out there's like a former disgruntled business partner. But all of this seems to have turned the DCCC off from this more prominent candidate to go with, I think, the safer option.
Yeah, potentially. But for me, the magic really is on the Republican side. For me, the magic really is how evenly matched are, Scott Baugh and Rohrabacher. And one of the things that I think is really striking about this district, and we talk about this a lot, the voters who are likeliest to vote in the primary are the small percentage of voters who feel most strongly about their politics. But these are the far right. And one of the challenges, I think, is that if we took a straw poll of every resident in that district between Baugh and Rohrabacher, I think they'd probably come out pretty close to a dead tie. But when you actually start to narrow to this smaller proportion of the electorate that's going to be much more conservative, much more activist, I think that's much more the Rohrabacher base. That's much more the mavericky Republican brand. It's not like the middle-of-the-road individuals that live in Orange County and might be registered as a Republican, but they're mostly there for the presidential elections or there for the general elections.
Let's open this up to some of the other races, because we've talked a little bit about how this is a more general problem. Jack, can you tell us, where the top two concern, I guess, is at its highest?
Well, you got several. You have a very competitive race to succeed Ed Royce, who is another Republican who, like Daryl Issa, decided to retire. Then you have Issa's seat. He represents a little bit of Orange County and San Diego County. So you take these together, and again, absolute numbers, not that great, but in a very closely divided House of Representatives could be crucial.
Yeah, and I'm just going to plug our first episode of our podcast where we go really in depth into the race for Daryl Issa's seat. If you haven't heard that one, you should tune in and hear about the wealthiest member of Congress, the thorn in Obama's side, who is now in this potential blue wave deciding to retire. Although, speaking of that potential blue wave, Paul, I think that you are skeptical.
Yeah. First off, when you think about a blue wave, it's usually talked about nationally. And it's really important to think about it within the context of the last two rather huge red waves that we had. In 2010, right after Obama got elected, and in 2014, nationally, Republicans grew to the greatest prominence, single-party control of legislatures, governor's office, and numbers of members of Congress, the greatest number of single-party control since 1929. They nationally, Republicans, had flipped 1,100 seats for the legislature, for Congress, governor's offices, 1,100 seats that were previously held by Democrats as from 2008 and earlier. They got flipped to be Republican. Those are the low-hanging fruit in the country, is these 1,100 individuals who won an election being anti-Obama and being pro-Tea Party. How many of those are in California? None. Not one. In fact, in California in 2010, we were the only state that actually had a Democratic pickup. In the whole country, not one legislative district in the whole country went from Republican to Democrat except for one, and that was here in Sacramento. So we can talk about a blue wave, but we do have to think about it in the California context. We have a super minority of Republicans in the legislature. We have a super minority of Republicans in our delegation that goes to Congress. We have had blue waves in 2008. We had a blue wave in 2010. We had a blue wave in 2012. We had arguably a blue wave in 2016 with this county, Orange County, we're talking about voting Democratic for the first time in I don't know how long. These Republicans that survived 2016 and have survived the past Democratic waves are kind of like the antibody-resistant Republicans, right?
They're like super battle-tested.
Yeah, they're battle-tested. These are not Republicans that are low-hanging fruit that owe their victory to being the most anti-Obama person around, and that's the wave in which they were swept in, and an anti-Trump wave being the wave in which they could be swept out. These are much more firmly rooted than I think people give them credit for. And a gubernatorial election cycle is generally much more Republican than Democratic in terms of turnout. So I think both of those things require us to think about the blue wave in California a little bit different context. We might see Democrats pick up a seat or two in Congress. I think that that would be pretty incredible in a gubernatorial election cycle. What we do see now that we haven't seen before is an investment in candidates and money and organizing and the DCCC setting up an office in Orange County. A lot of these things wouldn't have happened if it weren't for this potential for a blue wave. 2020, if these seats aren't won by Democrats in 18, I guarantee you they're going to gear right up and try to take them in 20, which would be a better year for Democrats traditionally in terms of turnout. So suffice it to say that we could end up having a blue wave, and a blue wave in which Republican members of Congress in California still cling to their seats.
And there's a fascinating dynamic with the gubernatorial race, because there's a real possibility we could end up with a Democrat-on-Democrat race, which could depress turnout among Republicans and help Democrats running for Congress.
Yeah, and we looked a little bit about that in episode 2. Although, just to mention, I believe that Paul Mitchell, who is going to clearly be the resident skeptic, and you now have your head on our desk here, because we have to talk about this. Paul does not believe that it's going to become Democrat-on-Democrat, and you actually have something running the line here, don't you?
Well, I'm taking a sabbatical from talking about the Dem-on-Dem dynamics, but this is the overarching issue for me. Democrats and Republicans vote in silos. They're not fighting over any of the same voters. There is a silo of voters who are voting amongst the Democratic candidates and a silo of voters voting amongst the Republican candidates.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a crucial rule of elections, whether it's for the governor's race or whether it's for Congress or whatever, which is that we are not at a point in our society where voters are going across ticket. It's not like voters are saying, well, I will choose between Dana Rohrabacher or one of the Democrats, maybe. It's who's going to turn out, how enthusiastic are they to turn out, and then in that pool that turns out for Republicans, how does the vote split? In the pool that turns out for Democrats, how does the vote split? But you didn't say the one thing that I wanted to just follow up on, which is what happens if it goes Democrat on Democrat?
Well, I've made the bet repeatedly and tried to, like I said, taking a sabbatical from pontificating on the open primary, but there is a bet that I had made that I would run around the Capitol naked.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. But, what you're saying is exactly right. And we're actually seeing that already in the absentees that are being turned in. Independents largely don't vote in primaries. Those independents that do vote are more conservative than the Republican Party or more liberal than the Democratic Party, especially when you're talking about high propensity primary voters. They're not there to play games. They're there to fight for their much more conservative or much more liberal kind of values and pick candidates from one of those silos.
So, and then just to wrap all this up, we have ballots coming in right now. They're in the mail. People can mail in their ballots. And Paul, you're tracking those returns. Tell us how you're tracking this and just what stands out to you.
Yeah, so political data, we're a data vendor statewide. We actually sell data to the Republican and the Democratic parties and all the candidates for governor and people up and down the ticket. But one of the functions that we perform for campaigns is that when you mail in your ballot, we tell the campaigns, stop contacting them. So we do that because the county registrars in each of the 58 counties will put out, release a file that these are the voter IDs of people whose ballots have been returned. It allows the voters to go online, make sure their ballot came in, and allows us to tell, you know, the Gavin Newsom campaign or the John Cox campaign or the Harley Ruta campaign, these people, they're off limits.
Stop bothering them.
Stop bothering these people.
Stop bothering them.
So if you're listening to this and you want the calls to stop, one way to do it is to vote early.
And Paul Mitchell will make sure that the campaigns know to stop emailing you.
But one of the really interesting benefits of this is that we can actually then flag that back to the voter file, and we can do some of the same analysis that we provide to clients regularly on just like voter trends. And we can update every night, sometimes twice a day, how many people have returned ballots. And we're actually right now on the cusp of 1 million voters who have cast ballots. If you expect maybe 6 million ballots to be cast or something like that, then we're a healthy way along in this election. And when we look at those, there are a few things that are really striking. And anybody in the public can find this. First off, young people, 18 to 35-year-olds, they're a quarter of the voter file. But they're about 12% of people who have actually returned their ballots. So there's this complete drop-off. The second thing that we see that's striking and that is right out of the 2014-2010 playbook in terms of what we see in gubernatorial primaries is a overperformance of Republicans. There are about 26% of people who have been mailed a ballot, but 33% of the ballots that have come back in are Republican ballots. And mostly that's come at the expense of independent voters not turning in their ballots. The third thing that jumps out is the ethnicity of the voters that are returning ballots. We know that Latinos are 38% of the state's population, the largest ethnic group in the state. They're just about a quarter of the registered voters. And in terms of ballots that came in, it's only 14% of the ballots that have come in have come from Latinos. That's actually a little bit better than past gubernatorial primaries, but it still is striking. The largest ethnic group in the state is showing up at essentially 1/8 of the voter file.
So what is the takeaway so far from the ballots that have come in as it relates to the race for Dana Rohrabacher's seat?
Well, it's actually really interesting. We look at these different seats around Orange County, and we see some really different dynamics. In the race for Rohrabacher's seat, we actually see both Democratic overperformance, Democrats overperforming by 5 points, and Republican overperformance. It's independents that have kind of taken in the shorts. Independents are almost 30% of the voters, and they're not even 20% of people who have returned a ballot. When we look at other seats in Orange County, I know you've talked about other districts and other in other programs. In the 49th, the ISIS seat, we see a completely different dynamic. In the ISIS seat, we see Republicans, they're 37% of people who got ballots, and they're 37% of people who returned ballots, so they are flat. Democrats, on the other hand, are 4 points up of the above their what you would expect. And so these dynamics throughout different parts of Orange County, San Diego, and then even looking at the competitive districts in the Central Valley, you start to see differences in terms of these trends. And it's still early, but we can start to look at these and say, as an example, is there a blue wave? Well, right now, we don't see a blue wave in the rates of ballots being returned throughout the state, either in these individual districts or statewide.
National Democrats will try to change those numbers in the final week and a half before the primary. The DCCC and another major funding arm of the party, House Majority PAC, have now spent $3.5 million across the three districts considered most at risk of a lockout. That's Rohrabacher's, Darrell Issa's, and the other seat vacated by Congressman Ed Royce. For Republicans, this could be their best chance to preserve those seats by preventing Democrats the opportunity to consolidate around one candidate in the general election. The media outlet Talking Points Memo just reported a Republican group, American Future Fund, is now investing more than $500,000 specifically to back candidates who could place second in those races, like Scott Baugh. Next time, we'll find out how it all turned out. We'll check in with reporters after the June 5th primary to see whether Democrats were locked out, which Republicans have advanced, and what it tells us about which party could win the keys to the House in November. Thanks to today's guests, Claremont McKenna College Professor Jack Pitney and Paul Mitchell of Political Data Incorporated. Our podcast is produced by Sally Schilling and edited by Nick Miller. Chris Hagen is our digital editor, and the executive producer is Linnea Edmeyer. My brother Matt Bradford did our music and theme song. Check out Cap Radio's other election podcast by our other Ben, California's next governor. Ben Adler has interviewed all of the major candidates in that race. You'll find it at capradio.org/podcasts, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay up to date on all of your news, elections, and otherwise by tuning into Capital Public Radio. Go online to capradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News. This is Keys to the House. I'm your host, Ben Bradford. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.